It's now my considerable pleasure, Gladys, to introduce you to my next guest, who's sitting across from me in the studio, Geraldine Brooks, award-winning Australian journo and author. For years, she was the Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, covering 22 countries there and in Africa. She's covered the Iran-Iraq War, the Palestinian uprising, the death of the Ayatollah Khomeini, Somalia, Bosnia, the invasion of Kuwait, there's a Freudian slip, and the Gulf War. Now, her previous books have been non-fiction, Nine Parts of Desire, The Hidden World of Islamic Women, and Foreign Correspondence, for which she won the Kibble Award for Women Writers in 1999. And now, her first novel. It's called Years of Wonders, a novel of the plague. Geraldine, what on earth enticed you into the world of fiction, given your track record in other realms?
I stumbled into a little village in the rugged mountain spine of England in 1990, lured there by a sign that said Plague Village. And I don't know about you, but I'm with Oliver Sacks. He has an epigram in one of his wonderful books about neurology, and he says, tales of disease are better than 1,001 nights. So when I saw that sign, there was no way I could avoid going to the village. And in the village church, they had set out the story of what took place there in 1666.
When you say they'd set it out, in what form? Apart from the tombstones?
No, they had a little exhibition, because Eam didn't just have the plague. They took a unique decision to quarantine themselves and prevent the spread of infection into the surrounding towns and countryside.
How good is the document? How good are the documents?
We know the facts. We know that the plague arrived probably in a bolt of cloth sent up from London, where plague was raging at the time. We know that 2/3 of the villagers died within the year. We know that.
How do we know that? I mean, this bolt of cloth story is like a bolt from the blue.
The bolt of cloth story is the best they can fathom as to how the infection got to the village, because there was an itinerant tailor, and he did send for cloth from London, and it came, and he was the first to die of plague.
Right.
So that's the evidence chain there.
Would a modern epidemiologist consider this a likely hypothesis?
Yes, because we now know that it was the flea that was the guilty party in spreading the infection. And either there were fleas in the cloth, or there could have been flea feces, not to be too nice about it, because the bacteria, the bubonic bacteria, can also exist in feces for some time. That's a pretty likely scenario.
That's interesting, isn't it? We're talking about a novel, but you still sound like a journalist, a fact gatherer, aren't you?
Well, I gathered all the facts there were. And William Styron said a wise thing once. He said that the historical novelist works best if fed on short rations. So I gathered the facts and found that there was plenty that we can't know, and that's where the imagination gets room to roam.
We shall deal with your roaming imagination later. Let's go back to this bolt of cloth. Mm. It comes into the village, which is what, about 100 and...
It's about 250 people as best we can make out.
And 150 miles from London.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Fairly isolated. They knew about the plague. They knew all too well. How was the news spreading? Like the fleas?
It would have spread through travellers. They were a lead mining and sheep herding village, so they had to sell their lead. So there was trading back and forth. So the news would have spread that way.
Was there contemporary writing of much quality?
No, it was mainly an illiterate village. There's very little gentry there. So what we have in terms of written accounts of the plague year is very scant indeed. There's just three letters that have survived that the rector of Eam wrote. And then, of course, there are the wills, which are terribly sad documents, because they used to list every single thing that they had in their will and talk about who they wanted it to go to. And it gives you a sense of their material life, and very meagre it was too.
There was very little understanding of the dynamics of disease. How do they come to the decision to quarantine themselves?
Yeah, they didn't know about the flea, of course. They had all kinds of theories about how infection spread and what it was. They thought it was vengeance of God was one theory. They thought it was bad air that had somehow lodged over the village. But they did know that it spread from person to person, that there was something to do with
contact,
proximity.
Yeah.
Actually, interesting to me, the flea connection wasn't made until as late as 1898, a scientist finally put it together. But you'd be familiar with the nursery rhyme, "Ring a ring a rosies, pocket full of posies." That's a very good description of what was going on. The ring
is the first sign of infection, isn't it?
It's the infection gets in the bloodstream and it starts. It's a massive toxic bacterial infection, high fevers, and then you start to get hemorrhages under the skin, and that's the rings of roses.
A tissue, another symptom. The sneezing.
Yes, the sneezing and the pocket full of posies was the belief in the bad air. So they thought if they breathed through fresh herbs, that would keep them safe.
Who led the movement to quarantine? At least, who does it in the book?
In the book, as in history, it was the young rector who asked the village to take this extraordinary step. And he must have been really something, because we know about him. We know that he was young. He'd just taken holy orders at Cambridge. This was his first pulpit. And he was coming there. This was 2 years before the plague came to the village, so he hadn't been there long. He had to win the trust of these people who were mostly of a Puritan bent. They'd had a Puritan minister until he'd had to resign his pulpit when he refused to preach from the Book of Common Prayer. So their faith had been through an enormous upheaval already. And in comes this young man and manages to win them over to the extent that they'll take this decision.
You and I share an irreligious belief or a disbelief, but are equally fascinated by the phenomenon of religion. Had religion taken a bit of a hiding during the plague? Were people being separated from their beliefs by disappointment in God?
That's where the imagination has to work, because we don't know what they were thinking, because they didn't write journals, these people of Eam, so we don't have their thoughts. But I believe that the human heart is the human heart, whether it's in downtown Manhattan today or Eam in 1666. And I think that catastrophe and unspeakable loss drive some people to faith and must drive others away. And particularly
for every action, an equal reaction. It's like a law of physics.
Particularly in Eam, I think, because they'd done the moral thing. They'd been self-sacrificing.
Well, let's deal with that, because, of course, the effect of the quarantine wasn't to keep the plague out. It was to keep it in.
That's right. They made the decision to not flee. There's evidence that in London, up to 2/3 of the population, virtually anyone who could get out, left at some point during the Great Plague of London. And of those that stayed, 70,000 died, which was incredible mortality in a city of then 500,000 people.
Mm.
So the natural reaction was to flee. Sometimes the medical practitioners were the first out. You know, they were writing a pretty clear prescription about what to do by their own quick departure. But in Eam, the people decided to stay, and only one or two people didn't abide by the oath, the rich family in town being one of them, although their descendants to this day are denying it.
Oh, do they? It's still a contentious issue, isn't it?
They say, oh, they were meaning to move anyway.
They're the ones that bought all the first edition of the book and burned it, is that right? But you still get the royalties. You still get the royalties. So this, the Reverend William Mompesson?
That was the real rector.
Is quite a lad. Who would challenge his authority in the district? How powerful was the reverend in a village like this?
I think in a village like this he would have been extremely powerful. I think that it was interesting that the rector who'd left his pulpit, the Puritan, was back in the village by this time, and that could have only happened with the consent of Mompesson. He must have been a generous-hearted young man who let this guy come back, because they weren't supposed to be within 5 miles of their parish once they'd been kicked out. So there must have been a bit of a unity between them, and I think that the old rector, Stanley, probably shored up the case of the younger man. The only people of any clout apart from that would have been Because it was a lead mining village, it had laws unto itself. The whole lead mining code of England is a fascinating study that I never expected to undertake, but got into it doing this book. They had their own court, the Barmet Court, and the Barmeester was the leader of the lead miners, and the body of the mine would vote on punishments to be meted out to people who'd broken the lead laws and so forth. So they were influential people in town.
Let's go from the lead laws to the Boulder Stone.
Yes, this is still there. It's a wonderful place, Eam. It's incredibly evocative. The landscape's very dramatic to start with. It's on the side of the White Peak Mountain, and it's a sharp fall of land dropping away to a steep valley and rising to the moors. So you can imagine how you get a sense of the past there, and they've kept the village in a wonderful state of preservation. And at the southern edge, they have what was known as the boundary stone in the plague year, because that was the boundary of the quarantine, and they would have the carters would bring the goods for the village and leave them there, and the villagers hollowed out holes in the stone and filled it with vinegar, which was thought to be a disinfectant, and they would put their coin to pay for the goods in the vinegar-filled holes.
And because they needed deliveries, didn't they?
They
had to put a shopping list out.
Well, what happened was the Earl of Chatsworth, who was the nearest gentry landowner, agreed to, in payment for their self-sacrifice, if you like, to supply them with their necessities. But any extras they wanted, they had to pay for.
I'm talking to Geraldine Brooks about her fine novel, A Year of Wonders, published by HarperCollins. This is LNL on Radio National, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web. And before we were on air together, we were having a chat about contemporary events and about the mega deaths that seem to be about to overwhelm us. You've seen a lot of death. You've written about death previously. How do people act when death is close? And how do they act in your novel?
I think that one of the things that I learned from being in places in crisis is that there's a paradox. It's that you never feel as alive as you do when death is close. And it brings out lots of different things. It brings out a recklessness in some people, a rashness to do maybe heroic acts. Or
an eroticism?
Definitely an eroticism, sort of life yearning for itself. And I certainly saw that as a correspondent. Some very unsuitable liaisons were engaged in by colleagues by people I met. And I think it's a very highly charged time. And particularly in the Middle East, I saw a lot of women especially who'd been very sheltered and circumscribed in their lives, stepping out of their role and taking steps and assuming responsibility and leadership and being listened to in a way that they never would have without this crisis.
Did you see anger? Did you see a desire for retribution?
Interestingly, not in the thick of the crisis. I never saw any mob behavior. People, when they're fighting for their life, that they tended to be doing heroic things, putting their life at risk, certainly. One thing that I do write about in the book, though, and one thing that I think we see in our current situation is the rush to scapegoating. And in the book, the scapegoats are the healing women, the cunning women of the village, and people in their despair at this disease turn on their healers. And, you know, and I think we're seeing that now with the dreadful, dreadful backlash against Muslims and people who are perceived to be of Middle Eastern extraction.
Let me read the Gladys a couple of paragraphs from the early part of the book. Our village is a thin thread of dwellings, unspooling east and west of the church, the main road frays here and there into a few narrower paths that lead to the mill, to Bradford Hall, to the large farms and the lonelier crofts. We've always built here with what we had to hand, so our walls are hewn of the common grey stone, and the roofs thatched with heather. Behind the cottages on either side of the road lie tilled fields and grazing commons, but these end abruptly in a sudden rise or fall of ground. The looming edge to the north of us, its sheer face sharply marking the end of settled land and the beginning of the moors, and to the south, the swift, deep dip of the Dale. These are some of the thoughts from the heroine of your novel. Let's introduce her belatedly in our conversation. She's 18 years old, she's a widow, and she's a mum. Tell us about Anna Frith.
Anna Frith was suggested to me by half a line in one of the letters that the real rector wrote during the plague year. And it was after his wife had died and he was writing to his patron, and there's just a line that says, "Fortunately, my maid continued in health, which was a blessing, for had she quailed, I should have been ill set." And then I tried to find out if there was anything known about the real woman, and there wasn't a thing, so I was free to make her up. And I made her up as Anna, who's intelligent but not educated, who's the widow of a lead miner, and who works at the rectory and at Bradford Hall. So she's of the people, but she sees what the gentry is doing as well.
Well, she sees it very sharply and shrewdly, doesn't she? She's got a keen eye.
She's a woman who's hungered all her life for learning and has grabbed it wherever she could find it.
Now, picking up on what you just said about your observation of women in war zones in the 20th and indeed the 21st century, you depicted most of the women in Year of Wonders as very strong. Is this an ambit claim for history, or do you think it's absolutely defensible?
Oh, I come from a family of strong women, and I'm certainly, I think, drawn to them in my reporting life. I've tended to Even women whose strength wasn't always in what you'd call a positive direction, like the women of Hezbollah. I was very attracted to them and spent a lot of time with them in the Bekaa Valley trying to understand their militancy and how they could come out of a faith like Islam that's trying to keep them in their place and yet find a place within it that was unassailable as these, you know, actually all shooting, all hunting, meanest catch it women.
So you observe that paradox, and that in a sense goes into the title, Year of Wonders. There's a paradox. You're writing about mass death.
Yes, the title actually is nicked from Dryden's poem Annus Mirabilis, 1666. And I remember when I first read that poem as a teenager, I thought, what a strange title for a poem about the year that brought the plague, the great fire of London, and the war with the Dutch. But then as I started to think in Anna's way of using language, a girl who's been basically brought up in a very ecclesiastical sort of churchy, sitting in church listening to a sermon for, God help us, 4 hours on a Sunday. She would hear that word wonders in a very different way to the way we hear it. She would have been familiar with when God says to Moses, with this staff, thou shalt do my wonders, which included calling down on the Egyptians the first plague in recorded human history.
So it's a richer, deeper word than it is now.
Yes.
And way you apply it.
And also for Anna, it is a year of wonders because out of all this loss and grief, she finds her own strength and her own new direction.
This is a bit of a cheek. I now want to wrench you from the era of the plague into this year of wonders. And I want you to look back into everything you know and everything you've learnt about the way the world behaves and tell us how you're feeling about this perilous moment in history.
Nervous, like most people, I think. I'm feeling, and also a little angry, that this last period of great prosperity in the United States was so filled with self-satisfaction that the idea of the little dirty wars in dusty places didn't matter, that America was so big and rich and fascinating that they could all just afford to look at themselves and stop looking out to the world. And I think that this was epitomized for me with George W. during the election campaign, when a reporter asked him the names of some heads of state. And I thought about that when he was going to General Musharraf last week to ask for his assistance, and I remembered that he wasn't able to come up with that gentleman's name.
I'd forgotten that, yes.
Yeah. And at the time, he didn't seem too troubled by his ignorance, and people in the States didn't seem to mind it too much. There was a sort of feeling abroad that, oh, well, we don't need to know those people, and that's just for wonks like Al Gore. And now, of course, that's come back to bite in a very terrible way. And suddenly there's a crash course going on in Islam 101 and Afghanistan 101. And, you know, it's a bit late, but I, now thinking back on it, it's the outward turn of the United States during the Cold War was probably the anomaly. The isolationism is probably more to the real nature of the society.
Words of wisdom from Geraldine Brooks, author of Year of Wonders, a novel of the plague, published by HarperCollins and destined to not only be a bestseller, but a pretty good film. Have you worked out who's going to star as Anna?
Not yet. I'm hoping she's some wonderful unknown.